discuss how Britain, in the name of development aid, spawned corruption and injustice in Afghanistan for 20 years following the invasion. And we shall also look at growing tensions between regional rivals India and China, fueled by the construction of dams on the Brahmaputra River.
A British government watchdog report says much of the £3.5 billion aid London provided to Afghanistan following the invasion of the country in 2001 was not spent on humanitarian aid, as claimed by the government officials, but on military operations, which in turn spawned rampant corruption and injustice. This mammoth funding served to advance the broader geostrategic and military agenda of the neo-imperial powers in the conflict-ridden South Asian country instead of humanitarian aid, relief or construction, with almost all international bodies aiding in the endeavor.
The Independent Commission for Aid Impact, a government body tasked with scrutiny of British development aid, in a report published last month, denounced the use of aid budget to fund the salaries of Afghan police and military as a questionable use of UK aid. The British government splurged £252 million on the salaries of Afghan National Police and £400 million on Afghan security services over the last 6 years of its operations in the country. Despite efforts by aid officials to stop the funding, the government overruled the move as it sought to prioritize the transatlantic alliance in line with its coalition ally, the United States. The report cited the British government documents that describe the situation as an extreme form of state capture, which benefited a narrow group of Afghan political elites at the expense of the population at large. The report added that in these circumstances, there was little prospect of meaningful institutional development in the war-ravaged country. The largest UK contribution of £668 million was to the World Bank program designed to fund basic services such as health and education, infrastructure investment, agriculture and jobs, but none of it managed to make any material difference to the lives of Afghan people.
Well, sure, they left it as in a greater mess than they had when they got there. So that of course is the responsibility of the force that had been there for 20 years. Somehow cannot just leave and say, well, you're on your own now. But there has been little indication the United States is prepared to do that. They thought that they could set up a satrap state under their direct control. That didn't quite work. So instead, now that it does have a government, which seems to be relatively in control, not entirely, but relatively in control, they would have the opportunity to try and assist to repair some of the damage that had been done by the 20-year devastation that was the occupation of Afghanistan by U.S. and British and NATO forces, in effect.
The hasty and ignominious drawdown of American and British troops from Afghanistan last August, after two decades of military occupation and horrendous war crimes, left the South Asian country on the brink of a monumental humanitarian catastrophe. For 20 years, foreign invaders exploited the country in the name of development and democracy. 20 years down the line, the country's economy is devastated, terrorism and insecurity are at their peak, and earthquakes and natural disasters have increased. All these problems have been compounded by the freezing of Afghan assets by the U.S. government.
Foreign powers invaded Afghanistan in 2001, ravaged its natural resources, destroyed the country, and abandoned it in complete ruins. According to the World Bank, the landlocked South Asian country is the sixth poorest in the world, with a gross national income per capita of only $500. The UN estimates that 24 million Afghans, or more than half of the population, today suffer from acute hunger. An estimated 8.7 million are at risk of famine, and 5 million children are on the brink of starvation. The situation has been complicated by the freezing of Afghan national assets by the U.S. government, the suspension of foreign aid, and a crippling economic blockade.
Well, obviously, the Afghan war was very controversial for American citizens. I mean, the number of deaths, American deaths there, the amount of treasure that was spent in the military operations in Afghanistan, essentially, you know, robbed a lot of people of not only their livelihoods, but also the lives of loved ones. This is the reason why the U.S. Really was forced to pull out. Because of this, the popular opposition to continued operations in Afghanistan, but they did it in such a way that they wanted to try and go and then put it behind them and pretend it didn't happen. Now, obviously, people are aware of the tremendous cost in terms of those who lost their loved ones. I mean, this can all easily be counted. But the overall costs of that war are still probably much greater than has been indicated. And therefore, if the truth really comes out, the reaction against those forces who were responsible for it would be so great that it could really overturn the apple cart in the political situation here in the United States.
The invasion of Afghanistan, which was led by the U.S. and the U.K., was in the first place based on a false premise. 20 years of war destroyed the country and produced one of the largest refugee populations in the world, despite tall claims of development by the foreign powers. After the hasty withdrawal last year, the British government vowed to give asylum to thousands of Afghans who worked with British forces. But more than a year later, they remain trapped in Afghanistan or neighboring Pakistan, which only underscores the devastating impact of 20-year military occupation in the name of building democracy and humanitarianism.
Now, to have more insight on this, we are joined by Mr. Abdullah Khan from Islamabad. He's the Managing Director of Pakistan Institute for Conflict and Security Studies. Now, according to the British government watchdog, much of the aid the UK provided to Afghanistan between the year 2000 and 2020 served to entrench corruption and injustice in the country. Now, does that surprise you in any way?
Thank you very much for inviting me to your show. Actually, such revelation by the British watchdog does not surprise me because it is a well-known fact that much of the foreign aids and foreign money came into Afghanistan went to the corruption. That was the basic reason that despite all these efforts of 22 years, they could not build a nation, they could not build a state. All the state functionaries collapsed as soon as the Western forces withdrew from Afghanistan. So it was a well-known fact, and actually, there is another fact that the Americans and their allies, particularly the Americans, they actually supported this corruption by their decision-making, and certain individuals were arrested in the Gulf, one of the Gulf states, the brother of one of very influential personality in Afghanistan were arrested. Briefly, then American intervened and he was released. So the corruption was not something which was not known to the Western powers. It was well known to them and it was well known to everybody. And you see all these people who were in power during this foreign occupation, where are they? They all have gone out of the country because there is no more money in the country to earn. So unfortunately, they came here for some other reasons, which I may let you know in my another reply. But there was the corruption was not a problem at all for the Western powers.
Now, Mr. Khan, instead of spending on humanitarian issues, the report says that billions of dollars worth of foreign aid was designed for broader geostrategic and military agendas in Afghanistan. Now, does that explain the basic aim of invading and occupying the country?
You know, from the fact that when 9/11 happened, after that, everybody knew that the then government of Taliban, although they have a lot of problems with them, but none of the Taliban leaders was involved in planning or executing, or even they didn't know about the 9/11. There was a strategic game which was planned and played in Afghanistan, on the soil of Afghanistan. Nation building or anything else was never an objective by the Western powers, unfortunately. And all that money came here was for some strategic designs. And eventually they failed because it is not possible for you to come invest in a country and try to change its values. The West came here and they tried to impose their version of democracy here, try to tell the people how to behave, how to, you know, do your daily lives, how to alter your values, which failed. Their prime objective was to use Afghanistan as a strategic chip against other countries in the region like China, Iran, Russia. And for 20 years, they invested. And because their intention was not clear, their intention was nefarious. And that is perhaps the reason that they failed. They never came here for some positive design. So for these Western rich countries, such amount of money is perhaps nothing to lose if their strategic designs are served.
Thank you for being on the program, sir. Now, let's see how people have reacted on social media.
London-based political activist Mervyn Hardwick says much of the UK's £3.5 billion aid to Afghanistan between 2000 and 2020 was spent as a cover for military domination. Patrick Wintour, Guardian diplomatic editor, cited an official review to note that the British aid to Afghanistan, largely directed by the US, only entrenched corruption and injustice. British barrister Jane Heybrook remarks that the speed with which the US and UK abandoned Afghanistan last year was to prepare for the next theater of war in Ukraine.
You're listening to The Subcontinent, broadcast by IRIB English Radio. This weekly program reviews ongoing developments in India, Pakistan, and Bangladesh. Listen to The Subcontinent every Monday here on IRIB English Radio.
Amid China's plan to construct a super hydropower dam on the Brahmaputra, a transboundary river that flows through South Asia and represents a source of life for more than 130 million people in China, India and Bangladesh, Sino-India tensions have taken a new form and dimension. The Brahmaputra is deemed one of the basins most at risk for interstate water conflict. Although an all-out water war seems less probable, the strategic river continues to be intricately connected to tensions between India and China, complicating their long-lasting territorial dispute.
More than 2 years after China announced plans to build the 60-gigawatt super hydropower dam in Taiwan on the Brahmaputra River, close to the boundary with India, India is also mulling over constructing a 10-gigawatt dam to offset the impact of water flows from China's dam. The Chinese project, which was included in the country's five-year plan for 2021 to 2025, is poised to be the world's biggest dam that will come up in the foothills of the Himalayas. The Brahmaputra, which originates in the Qinghai-Tibet Plateau in southwest China, flows 2,900 kilometers across southern Tibet via the Himalayas before entering India. Each country in the region seeks to maximize its utilization, including India and China. The relations between China and India over shared water resources remain deeply complicated, with the Brahmaputra being essential to their socio-economic development. It accounts for nearly 30% of India's freshwater resources and 40% of its total hydropower potential. For China, the river's role in the freshwater supply is limited, but it plays a key role in Tibet's agricultural and energy industries. Despite China's insistence that the dam activity is meant for hydropower generation, India remains deeply skeptical adding to tensions between the two countries.
The long-lasting territorial dispute between India and China only complicates matters, with both Asian giants asserting competing claims on the territory in the Eastern Himalayas administered by India. That has caused a deep trust deficit between the two sides on all matters, including shared water resources, and both countries today accuse each other of hydro-hegemonic behavior in the region, with the Brahmaputra being a flashpoint. Due to their geographical location, upstream countries are in a position to manipulate the water flows for their strategic gains.
As the upstream superpower of the region, China does not have any transboundary river policy, but manages the issues bilaterally with downstream countries. It also has not signed a water-sharing treaty with any country. Domestic challenges, including the need for energy security and the global infrastructure development project called the Belt and Road Initiative, mainly drive the country's water diplomacy. Interestingly, many of China's downstream neighbors, including India, have also not signed any such agreement. India has long feared that China intends to use the hydropower dams to assert its control over the Brahmaputra, with many speculating that it will potentially lead to water wars between the two Asian powers. India has repeatedly blamed China for stemming the flow of the Brahmaputra, damaging the ecology and disrupting agricultural production in the country. China has dismissed the criticism. The construction of super hydropower dams on the river is now adding a new dimension to the narrative of water wars between the two sides. Indian media has been aggressively pushing the narrative, while Chinese media has rejected as an absurd theory. Although it is still under construction, its size and the potential impact on river flows have heightened India's fear of water shortage, aggravating geopolitical tensions.
Now, to talk more on this, we are joined by Andrew K.P. Leung from Hong Kong. He's an international and independent China strategist. Now, the already fragile relationship between regional rivals India and China is set to become tenser amid Beijing's plan to build a super hydropower dam on the Brahmaputra River near India and India's counter plan. So how do you see this fresh duel playing out?
The Himalaya represents one of the world's most dynamic and systems because it supplies water to China, India, and also Bangladesh. And then apart from the Brahmaputra, there is the Ganges River, there's the Indus River, and a number of other major rivers flow through from the Himalayas, freshwater systems. Now, this water systems supplied population downstream, numbering some 1.9 billion people in so many different countries. And then these countries rely on this water, not just for drinking, but also for fisheries, for irrigation. So it's hugely important for their economies and the livelihood of the people. Now, of course, China is in the upstream position in the Himalayas. And China, like some other Asian countries, are very water deficit countries, particularly China. China has got the one-fifth of the world's population, but the average water availability in China, the fresh water availability, is only a third of the world average. The world average, of course, includes the most arid regions in the world, including sub-Saharan Africa. And there is not much water up north in China, too much water down south, resulting in major floods. And other countries also rely on water, as I said, not just for drinking, but for agriculture, but also for the cotton, the feeding cotton, feeding the industries.
Mr. Leung, as one of the world's most impoverished regions, each country in South Asia wants to maximize the utilization of the Brahmaputra River, which is known as Yarlung Sango in China. Why is this river so important for India and China in achieving development goals?
It's important for China because China, as I said, is a water-poor country and relying on fresh water from the Himalayas, not only for the the western regions in China bordering the Himalayas, but then the water also flows from the western part of China to other parts of China to the east. So it's a very important water system to China. Likewise, the water flows down India, Bangladesh, at least the Brahmaputra. As I said, there are other river systems like the Ganges, the Indus River flowing through India and Pakistan as well. And all these countries depend on these freshwater systems, not only for drinking, as I said, but for agriculture, for cotton, for industry, and for their economic survival. And then ecologically, these waters also affect the ecology of the downstream. For example, the Irrawaddy River flows through Myanmar and Laos and various other countries down south. Now, as the water gathers after the monsoon, it's going to create a great deal of water, trapping small fish in some of the vegetation. And then as the water recedes, the fish is harvested by the local population. So this, again, feeds into the kind of fisheries industries in these countries. And if the water flow is disrupted, either upstream by dam building, or because of climate change, is going to affect the livelihood of billions of people.
Now, Mr. Leung, both South Asian giants accuse each other of hydro-hegemonic behavior, and both have refused to sign a water-sharing or international transboundary water treaty. So the question is, why is this?
Well, this again, geopolitics, rivalry, mistrust, especially between countries like China and India, which have experienced border disputes and also geopolitical rivalry, especially in this time when a lot of the Western countries, especially the United States, which in a way allied with India, is pushing back against China. And then, of course, the questions like Tibet and the border disputes or border crashes exacerbate this conflict. But however, this river system affecting livelihood of so many people is going to be a major powder keg that's not only affecting India and China, but various other countries downstream. So I think that China and, of course, India and other countries are likely to handle these questions very carefully. And I think the whole thing can only be resolved by further discussions, further negotiations. And there's no point, and it won't help matters if this worsen or accelerate a downward spiral into a war.
Last but not least, India and China have been embroiled in a historical territorial dispute, and now the water dispute only risks more escalation. So what could be its possible repercussions for the region and the world?
As I said, I mean, it's going to exacerbate this kind of disputes in a time of global geopolitics involving the rivalry, confrontation between China and the United States and some of its so-called allies, including India. And of course, there is a global a rivalry and pushback of the United States against China and perceived as its main near-peer challenger for American dominance. So all these are mixed up together, and we are going to have to be facing a very unstable world, I'm afraid, in the coming decades.
Thank you for being on the program. Now, let's see how people have reacted on social media.
Shehzad Yunus, an economic analyst, says the already fraught relationship between regional rivals China and India is becoming even more tense over Beijing's plans to build a super hydropower dam in Tibet. A Twitter user, Jari Jamponen, notes that China's dam on the Brahmaputra would be the world's biggest, with capacity of 60 gigawatt, adding that India, too, is considering building a 10 gigawatt dam to counter China's project. Sitan Sibal, a New Delhi-based journalist, cites India's Defense Minister Rajnath Singh commenting on latest border clashes between Indian and Chinese forces. He says the matter has been raised diplomatically.
And that was our episode about the British military's agenda in Afghanistan in the name of development and the India-China tensions over the shared water resources. We shall meet again next week. So till then, take great care.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program.
In the limelight.
Moscow charged Kiev's Western backers with ignoring its warnings that NATO's informal expansion into Ukraine was crossing Russia's red line. Officials in Moscow said Ukraine is being used for a proxy war against Russia by the United States and its allies, and they want to destroy Russia with illegal sanctions. But Russia will confront them and is trying to increase its economic interactions with countries of East Asia and the subcontinent, such as China and India, to deal with the economic sanctions. We take a look at the world media's coverage of this issue. Please stay with us. Sputnik News Agency has covered the story. Russian Deputy Foreign Minister Alexander Grushko said on Friday, 16th of December, imposing new sanctions on Moscow is a choice of the European Union, but these measures undermine the interests of the member states of the European Union as well. The Russian Deputy Foreign Minister Alexander Grushko said, European Union states are abandoning market principles in energy, finance, and in many other areas. This is their choice. But this choice, when implemented in concrete actions, undermines international economic relations in the form in which they have been formed in recent years and undermines the economic interests of these countries. The Russian diplomat said it is impossible not to see that all these sanctions benefit the United States, adding that Russia will develop measures to ensure its economic interests. On Thursday, 15th of December, the European Union agreed in principle on the ninth package of sanctions against Russia. The final technical procedure for the execution of these sanctions package completed on Friday, 16th of December, after which the sanctions must be published in the EU official journal. After that, they will come into force. After Moscow launched its special operation in Ukraine last February, the US, the European Union, and Britain imposed economic restrictions against Russia. In October of this year, the EU adopted its eighth package of sanctions against Moscow, which included a legislative basis for setting a price cap for maritime shipments of Russian oil to third countries. In December, the European Union also joined the G7 decision to set a price cap on Russian oil at $60 per barrel. The cap will be reviewed every 2 months to remain at 5% below the International Energy Agency benchmark. However, Moscow refused to accept the price limit, saying that Russian oil would only be sold to countries on a market basis. So far, the sanctions have resulted in a major fuel crisis in Europe, record high inflation, and skyrocketing energy prices. English website of Al-Sharq al-Awsat newspaper has also covered the same story. Russia says the European Union's latest round of sanctions against Moscow will just exacerbate economic woes within the European bloc. The latest measures, which blacklist nearly 200 more people and bar investment in Russia's mining industry, are part of the ninth wave of sanctions imposed on Russia since President Vladimir Putin ordered the launch of a special operation in Ukraine on 24th of February this year. Russian Foreign Ministry spokeswoman Maria Zakharova reacted to the measures on Saturday, 17th of December. Zakharova said the current package will have the same effect as all the previous ones, exacerbation of socio-economic problems in the European Union itself. Maria Zakharova also called on the European Union to cancel all restrictions that are having a direct or indirect impact on Russian exports of grains and fertilizers. Russian President Vladimir Putin said recently Kremlin would expand trade cooperation with new partners, including by sharply ramping up gas exports to China. Back in November, the Chinese President Xi Jinping reassured he is willing to build a closer partnership with Russia in the energy sector. Citing an Indian oil ministry source, the Reuters news agency reported recently that New Delhi will continue buying Russian oil and even look for term contracts as sanctions allow purchases, provided that Western services are not used. China and India are currently the largest buyers of Russian crude oil. German newspaper Bild am Sonntag has also covered the same story. The German newspaper Bild am Sonntag reports on Saturday, 17th of December, that dozens of Russians and Belarusians have filed lawsuits at the EU Court of Justice to challenge their inclusion on the sanctions list. The Luxembourg-based court has reportedly received claims that from one company and 61 individuals from Russia and Belarus placed on the EU blacklist over their alleged support for Moscow's special operation in Ukraine. The business figures are seeking to challenge what they view as a violation of their rights and the freeze of their assets by European Union authorities. According to media reports, the plaintiffs in Luxembourg include Russian billionaire and former owner of the English football club Chelsea, Roman Abramovich, ESN Group owner Grigory Berezkin, and Gennady Timchenko, who owns Volga Group, a Russia-based company with interests in the energy sector, transportation and construction. Alpha Group co-founder Mikhail Friedman and Alisha Usmanov, the owner of Russia's largest iron ore producer, are also among those who are suing. The European Union has adopted 9 rounds of anti-Russia sanctions since last February, when Moscow launched its special operation in Ukraine. Aside from business people, the penalties include measures against Russian journalists and Russian companies. On Friday, 16th of December, the European Union blacklisted 141 Russian individuals and 49 legal entities, including ministers, governors, judges, parliament members, singers and presenters, as well as 5 political parties. The latest measures also deprived 4 more Russian media outlets of their broadcasting licenses in the European Union, introduced a number of export bans, and extended restrictions on 3 more Russian banks. Export restrictions were extended to 168 additional Russian entities closely linked to the Russian military-industrial complex, bringing the total number of sanctioned companies to 410. Meanwhile, European leaders approved an 18 billion euro macro-financial assistance package for Ukraine for 2023 to ensure that Kiev can cover state deficits and keep the economy running as it continues to fight Russia. To fund the aid and loan it to Kiev at a highly concessional rate The European Union will raise common debt, a proposal that initially met resistance from Hungary. But Budapest lifted its veto recently after EU nations agreed to allow the sum of the EU funds it has frozen under the new law of law mechanism from 7.5 billion euros to 6.3 billion euros. A Polish veto over the introduction of a minimum global corporate tax also threatened the adoption of the assistance package on Thursday, 15th of December. But Warsaw, a staunch supporter of Ukraine, also lifted its objection. Russia launched its special operation in Ukraine last February following Kiev's failure to implement the terms of the Minsk agreement and Moscow's recognition of the breakaway regions of Donetsk and Luhansk. At the time, Russian President Vladimir Putin said one of the goals of his special operation was to denazify Ukraine. Since the outbreak of war, the United States and its European allies have imposed an array of sanctions on Russia while supplying the large cache of advanced weaponry to Ukraine, despite warnings from Moscow.
The wildfires in Greece, Turkey, the United States.
Palestinian prisoners in Israeli jails continue to engage in hunger strikes.
Kim Yo-jong, the powerful sister of North Korean leader.
On the news line.
Japan is allocating $320 billion in an effort to build up its military, a move that would be unthinkable under previous administrations. But now, under the Liberal Democratic Party led by Prime Minister Fumio Kishida, surveys say the budget has the favor of over 70% of voters. The military developments include extending the range of Japan's missiles, stockpiling of spare parts and other munitions, reinforcing logistics, developing cyber warfare capabilities, and cooperating more with US and other like-minded countries. The extension of the range of Japanese missiles is only meant to be able to reach China, if the need were to ever arise, as there is no other reason to extend the range to around 1,000 kilometers. The reason why Japan feels the need to advance its missile technology is the escalation of tensions in the Indo-Pacific region. North Korea has, on multiple occasions, tested intercontinental ballistic missiles capable of carrying nuclear warheads, one of which landed a little too close for comfort to Japan. The China-Taiwan tensions are also cause for concern for Japan, as a potential military escalation could put Japan in danger as well. This is because of the large number of troops and massive amounts of supplies that the U.S. has stationed in Japan, which they would most likely take advantage of in case of an escalation with Taiwan. Here's what Prime Minister Kishida said with regards to the military build-up plan.
We can feel a rapid increase in the severity of the security environment around our country. In countries and the regions surrounding our country, a strengthening of nuclear and missile capabilities, a rapid military build-up, and attempts to unilaterally change the status quo through power are becoming more pronounced.
Kishida also emphasized on the issue of China as a challenge to its security. He said, China's current external stance and military trends are a challenge to our country's peace and security, the securing of global peace and stability, and the enhancement of international order based on the rule of law. To which Chinese Foreign Ministry spokesman Wang Wenbin responded by saying, Japan disregards the facts, deviates from the common understandings between China and Japan, and its commitment to bilateral relations, and discredits China. Japan even believes that Russia is a threat to its security, albeit indirectly. Tokyo sees Russia's war in Ukraine as a dangerous precedent that might encourage China to carry out a similar operation in Taiwan and cause unimaginable disruption to world trade. By taking stances against North Korea, China, and Russia, Japan must look to the US and South Korea as its allies. $320 billion. Once the budget is injected into Japan's military, it will bump up Japan's ranking among the top military spenders in the world from 8th place all the way up to 3rd place, just below the US and China, even higher than Russia during a time of war. And this amount of expenditure is going to hurt Japanese economy. Kishida's plans will double Japan's defense outlays to about 2% of the country's gross domestic product over the next 5 years. It would also mean that Japan's defense ministry will now have 10% of the country's entire annual public spending. In the document that outlines the plan for the military expenditures, what is not included is how the money will come about. It's unclear whether the government will have to raise money through tax increases or whether it will borrow the money. But if we look at the reason behind this unprecedented amount of spending on military by Japan, that is known for its pacifist constitution, we will realize that if not for the US's recent provocative actions, Japan would not deem its security threatened. North Korea's ICBM missile tests only came about as a result of US provocations, and the North Korean leader Kim Jong-un has mentioned this on multiple occasions. With regards to the issue of Taiwan, if not for the meddling of the US in Taiwan's affairs and the breaking of the One China policy that the US had previously agreed to, China would not have conducted the biggest military exercise in its history. If not for the constant eastward expansion of NATO, spearheaded by the US, the war in Ukraine would also not have happened, and Japan's concerns over Russia encouraging China to also attack Taiwan would never come to be. It's almost as if Japan's alliance with the US is costing them more money than it's bringing in. And that is completely disregarding the security risks that this alliance has brought upon the land of the rising sun.
Iran has wrapped the European Union over anti-Tehran measures taken by the Council of the European Union. Foreign Minister Hossein Amir Abdollahian denounced, quote, certain political shows that have been put on display by the Council under the pretext of defending the issue of human rights. The European Council has imposed a slew of fresh sanctions against Iranian natural and legal entities. According to a statement issued by the EU foreign ministers, 20 individuals, along with one entity, the Islamic Republic of Iran Broadcasting, have been sanctioned over alleged human rights abuses. The bloc has also slapped sanctions on 4 more people and has many entities blacklisted over Tehran's alleged drone supplies to Russia. The bloc's new sanctions include asset freezes and travel bans to the EU. The ministers condemned what they called the widespread use of force by the Iranian authorities against protesters. The European Union last month imposed sanctions on a number of Iranian institutions and individuals, including the 24-hour English-language press TV news channel, over alleged rights violations following the recent foreign-backed riots in the country.
In the case of Iran, big tech is used as a weapon against Iranians. So Iranian voices don't come out. Iranians lose their, if they are opposed to the Western narrative, they get sanctioned. All of the Iranian media is sanctioned. Many individuals have lost their accounts. I have lost my Facebook and Instagram accounts. So these Western big tech companies, they cooperate with Western governments, but in Iran, these same media outlets make threats, They support, they help people make Molotov cocktails, and they help mobilize the rioters.
Foreign-backed riots have hit various Iranian provinces since 22-year-old woman Mahsa Amini died at the hospital on September 16th, 3 days after she collapsed at a police station. An investigation has attributed Amini's death to a medical condition rather than alleged beatings by the police. The violent riots have claimed the lives of dozens of people and security forces while also allowing terrorist attacks across the country. In the last 2 months, the terrorists have set fire to public property and tortured several Basiji members and security forces to death. Western states have been hyper-aggressively pushing the regime change agenda in form of hybrid war, making a sheer mockery of international law. Authorities in the US and the EU have openly and brazenly instigated rioters in Iran through official and unofficial channels. Iran's intelligence ministry has said the United States and the United Kingdom were directly involved in the unrest, adding that dozens of terrorists affiliated with the Israeli regime and anti-revolution groups have also been detained in the unrest.
Online, the MEK organization that's funded by and supported by NATO, they've been teaching people how to make Molotov cocktails, how to use weapons, and they've been attacking police bases, military bases, and also we've had terrorist attacks alongside the Pakistani border, in the no man land in Pakistan, and also in northern Iraq from Iraqi Kurdistan.
Iran says its enemies have waged a hybrid war against the Islamic Republic to weaken national solidarity and hinder the country's progress. Officials say huge amounts of weapons have been shipped into the country by Western and regional intelligence services to carry out terrorist attacks and conduct extensive psychological operations in order to stoke dissatisfaction amongst the Iranian people and make them accuse the Iranian administration for the growing insecurity.
The United States is finalizing plans to send Patriot missile systems to Ukraine. The plan needs the final approval of U.S. Defense Chief Lloyd Austin and the U.S. President Joe Biden. It is not known how many of the batteries will be sent to Ukraine, but reports say supplies to Ukraine will be limited. But according to available data, a typical Patriot battery includes a radar set that detects and tracks targets, computers, and a power-generating equipment. It also includes an engagement control station and up to 8 launchers, each holding 4 radio-fire missiles. The systems are likely to be sent to the U.S. Army base in Grafenwöhr, Germany, where Ukrainian soldiers are likely to be trained and use the equipment. Ukraine has long been requesting the U.S. to send advanced long-range air defense system.
The message is simple. Give Patriots as soon as you can. Because this is the system that Ukraine needs to protect its civilian population and critical infrastructure. This is not an offensive weapon.
Russia has already warned that Patriot missile systems in Ukraine, if are deployed in the conflict, will be targeted. The former Russian President Dmitry Medvedev, who is now Deputy Chair of the National Security Council, had earlier warned that such weapons and their crews would be legitimate targets if a NATO member were to deliver them.
Washington уже сделал себя стороной конфликтов в практической плоскости. Принимая во внимание растущие объемы прямой американской военной помощи, включая присутствие военнослужащих США на земле, передача столь сложного вооружения, обращение с которым требует многомесячной подготовки, будет означать расширение вовлеченности кадровых американских военных в боевые действия со всеми вытекающими последствиями. Настоятельно советуем тем, кто в Вашингтоне принимает решение, наконец прислушаться, возможно, не к нам, но к самим себе, сделать правильные выводы из наших неоднократных предупреждений о том, что любые поставляемые на Украину оружейные системы, в том числе Patriot, соответственно, обслуживающим персоналом, были и остаются законными приоритетными целями для вооруженных сил России.
The U.S. and its Western partners have already resupplied Ukraine's air defense missiles and shoulder-fired Stinger missiles and other larger air defense systems. Patriot missile system is one of the most advanced U.S. systems against aircraft and missiles. Ukrainian officials say the delivery of Patriot missiles would be a game changer, but the efficiency of those weapons for Ukraine in the war against Russia is not clear. Each missile battery would require dozens of well-trained air defenders to operate. Even with an accelerated training program, could be sometime in early 2023 before a system is operational in Ukraine. Experts believe the Patriot has a more powerful radar that is better at discriminating targets, but it has its own limitations. Its efficiency would depend on how the weapon was delivered. The success rate of the Patriot has been repeatedly questioned. In 2018, Saudi Arabia's success in using Patriots against missiles fired in the Yemen war were questioned when evidence of systems failing emerged. The Patriot does not reportedly perform so well against small drones. It is not known whether the system's radar could pick up the small, low-flying drones or whether there were other issues. The U.S. has now committed more than $19.3 billion in weapons and other equipment to Ukraine since the war began in February of this year.
As we work with industry to accelerate production on both replenishment systems and direct procurements under the United Ukraine Security Assistance Initiative, or USAI, we're using a number of tools to get the funding moving and the contracting happen quickly. These include using contracting mechanisms called things like undefinitized contracting actions, sometimes called UCAs. What that allows you to do deliberately is to get industry working on an initial contract before we definitize it. And you can put a UCA together within a week, and we're doing that. We also are making use of indefinite delivery indefinite quantity contracts, or IDIQ. If you have IDIQs, and we have many of them, what you can do is just add task orders to them very quickly to get equipment on contract.
It is widely believed that those U.S.-made weapons are fanning the flames of war in Europe. But there are concerns that those weapons are falling into the wrong hands.
We're seeing this incredible, historic flow of weapons coming into Ukraine. Do we have any sense as to where they're going?
We don't know. There is really no information as to where they're going at all.
You know, all this stuff goes to the border, and then kind of like something happens, it kind of like 30% maybe reaches its final destination.
Washington is reportedly looking into technological solutions to the problem of weapons diversion. Western weapons earmarked for Ukraine had reportedly surfaced in the hands of militant groups in the African Sahel.
The United Nations Children's Agency, UNICEF, says more than 11,000 Yemeni children have been killed or maimed since the Saudi-led aggression against the impoverished country began in 2015. The agency says hundreds of thousands of children also remain at risk of death from starvation or preventable diseases. That's while the true toll of the conflict is likely to be far higher. According to the agency, about 2.2 million Yemeni children are acutely malnourished. One quarter of them aged under five. Most of them are at extreme risk from cholera and other vaccine-preventable diseases. Described as the world's worst humanitarian crisis by the UN, nearly three-quarters of Yemen's population is said to be in need of humanitarian aid and protection. UNICEF is seeking over $480 million to respond to the crisis in Yemen over the next year, and has warned that lack of predictable funding puts children's lives and well-being further at risk. The agency has also called on the warring sides to renew a UN-brokered truce, which was announced in April and expired in October without an agreement to extend it. At least 62 children have been killed or wounded since then. The collapse of Yemen's ceasefire risks rolling back some of the progress that has been made after the lifting of a Saudi blockade on Yemen that has prevented airplanes and ships from entering and leaving the country. While both sides have blamed the other for failure of a lasting ceasefire, Yemen's Ansarullah movement has stated that restoring peace in Yemen is not possible unless the invading countries abandon their arrogant mentality. Saudi Arabia, along with some of its regional allies, launched a devastating war on Yemen in 2015 with arms and logistics support from the U.S. and other Western states. The objective was to reinstall the Riyadh-friendly regime of Abd Rabbu Mansour Hadi and crush the popular Ansarullah movement, which has been running state affairs in the absence. Hundreds of thousands of Yemenis have died ever since, either as a result of war or indirectly through unsafe drinking water, disease outbreaks, hunger, and other impacts. In Yemen, thousands of civilian and child deaths have been blamed on Saudi-led airstrikes, which have hit markets, weddings, funerals, residential homes, and hospitals. In addition, Yemen's health ministry said last month that 80 newborn babies lose their lives on a daily basis because the war-torn country does not have the required medical equipment due to the Saudi-led war and blockade. Yemeni officials say the use of prohibited weapons is one of the reasons behind a growing trend of children's death. Several human rights organizations have already acknowledged and condemned Saudis for using such arms. Since launching the war, with the support of Washington, the Saudi-led coalition has used internationally banned weapons, including U.S.-made cluster bombs to target residential areas. Apart from the war, Riyadh has imposed a blockade on Yemen, which combined have claimed lives of hundreds of thousands of people. The military aggression has destroyed much of the country's infrastructure, including health sector. Meanwhile, Sana'a has warned foreign companies against plundering energy resources of the country, stressing that it will spare no effort to defend national sovereignty and safeguard public interests and health. The Saudi-led coalition and their proxies have looted more than $13 billion in Yemeni oil revenues between 2016 and 2021. The large amounts could have been used to pay the salaries of employees in the National Salvation Government, reduce the exchange rate, and help improve the living standards for Yemenis and alleviate their suffering.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en. Under the starry sky of the desert, from the very heart of evergreen forests, with the radiance of silver-colored sand, in the midst of proud mountains,
closer. Iran.